drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. So I have a question for you, and I have a feeling I might get a different answer now than I did a year ago. How much personal information do you share on social media? Technology has changed how we navigate the world and our relationships with each other, but being in the midst of it, do we really understand what's changed? And in the midst of all this technology, what does it mean to be human? Professor Rosie Braidotti is a philosopher and distinguished university professor at Utrecht University. She's looking at all these issues in the Thinking Out Loud lecture series, and she's in the drawing room. Welcome.
Very nice to be here. Thank you, Patricia, for inviting me.
Your first lecture was on what counts as the human right now. So let's start there. What does count as human?
There's a slight sort of a Monty Python-ish tone to it, isn't it? The meaning of life, the meaning of being human. But it is a serious question. If you think of the amount of time we spend with our technologies and inside our technologies, my students, they cannot be separated from their iPhones or tablets or laptops. They are just an extension of their being. If you put one of my young students in a place that has no internet signal, they get claustrophobic. I mean, it is that intense. So at one level, indeed, our Facebook pages, Instagram, extensions of our memories, extensions of our existence, we spend so much time with them. But we are used to thinking of technologies as them, as something other than what we are. And I think what is happening now, given the speed and the intimacy of our relationship with these devices, that division between us and them is becoming more fluid. And we are beginning to think of ourselves as something that is sort of an enhanced human, a human with great capacities. And this is just at the personal level. If we project it on society with what artificial intelligence and robotics are going to be doing to our workforce, to our economy, to jobs, quite simply, well, then the issues become really, really complex. The last report of the OECD says we're going to be losing something like 66 million jobs to robotics and automation. So what is the value of the human in a world like this? I think that's a question not only for a philosopher, I think it's a question for everybody, parents, citizens, anybody that is alive, really.
Are we talking about the idea of transhumanism here, a change in the physical nature of humanity?
That is one of the currents that that is very visible and in some ways popular. The transhumanists believe that we need to enhance particularly our neural capacity, our mental capacities, in order to keep up with the computational networks and the technologies that we have ourselves created. It is a fact that our algorithms are faster than our good old brain. And there's a couple of seconds. It's not a huge difference, but enough to make the transhumanists who are essentially based at the University of Oxford and do really excellent work on becoming posthuman in that direction. They really want to enhance our brain through implants, through various interventions, so that we can match the speed of our own networks. And of course, it's a very complex argument because who is going to decide which sectors of the population are going to get enhanced? Is this the way to go about living with our technologies? Can't we slow them down so that they become more like us? And in any case, I am an old social democrat, so I would like to know who is making these decisions. Why are we not all of us discussing the terms of this great mutation that we are going through at the moment? There is an issue here about democracy.
There is certainly an issue around democracy, and we've seen that with all of the focus around Facebook and the harvesting of data and it being used to manipulate, exploit, and really to affect elections and our democratic system. I mentioned social media at the beginning of my introduction, and I set up this concept that, you know, a year ago we would have felt differently about social media to now. Does that show that we are having a significant conversation about this with ourselves, with our peers, with our families? Because I've noticed, at least anecdotally, that people are behaving a bit differently on social media, that people are having a reaction to oversharing and sharing information that they know is vulnerable.
I think you're right. I think that I think you have to trust to the wisdom and common sense of our people in any case. But on this particular issue, the alertness, the awareness is increasing very, very rapidly. There were studies, of course, and Australian universities have been at the forefront of analysis of how non-transparent, algorithmic culture, as people call it, really is. We've had WikiLeaks, we've had all kind of episodes that have shown the dangers involved into this. The problem is, of course, the addictive quality of these technologies and the social networks and their usefulness. You can really get so much stuff done. I mean, the Arab Spring and so many revolutions and social movements have been prompted by the existence of the social network. So I think we're in a kind of experimental phase, and that the work that I'm doing on becoming human, post-human, is tracking the different ways in which people go about fostering this dialogue and how fast we are learning and how savvy we are becoming. But in between, if it is true that Cambridge Analytica and a big university like Cambridge was involved in trading profiles and personal data for the sake of intervening not only in the American election, but on the British referendum on the EU, on Brexit, which I consider a massive catastrophe, well, then we need to actually work even faster to make sure that some sort of transparency, some sort of accountability comes into the picture. So we're learning, but in a sense, through mistakes and a certain amount of pain, a certain amount of discomfort, I think.
Now, addiction is a really interesting point because you're right. I mean, the observation you made about your students is an observation I've made about myself. Mm-hmm. There is kind of breaking into a sweat if you can't get onto mm-hmm. the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. This doesn't feel normal, and yet it's an experience people are having. It has to be linked to addiction. There's no other explanation for it. And addiction, of course, feels like such an essential part of human nature, of what it means to be human right now. So is it that technology is exploiting humanity and those worst parts of humanity, addiction and lack of control and not knowing boundaries around all of this?
There's always negative connotations around addiction. So I want to use it a little bit carefully. In my work on the post-human, I see that we have become indeed dependent on the enhanced capacities, on the enormous power that we get, power of connectivity through these devices. And we've constructed literally extension of ourselves. And I think we're still in the early phases of understanding that we are ourselves as human a little bit more than human. I call this the post-human in not so much a coercive transhumanist sense, but as certainly a broadening of our capacities. We need to learn to think differently about ourselves. And I think it's a question of self-understanding. Actually, we are immensely powerful in our means of connection, but how much can our bodies and our brains take? Now, we have cases now of couples' relationships breaking up because one of the partners has to get up at 2 a.m. to check the emails, not because that partner is having an affair or being unfaithful, but because there is a need, an addiction. You need the shot of mostly useless information that you get. And this is creating relationship issues. It's creating psychic issues, psychological issues. People are being detoxed. We have detoxing clinics for people who are completely obsessed by getting that message. So I see this as the preliminary phases of what I hope, but I am a pathological optimist, will be an enhanced relationship to what these technologies make possible. We are becoming human otherwise. And it's a positive thing. But at the moment, because we're still getting used to it, I think we're suffering a little bit. We maybe need to work a bit harder at it.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvalis. Professor Rosie Braidotti is my guest in the drawing room. I love your sense of optimism that there'll be a period where this is negative, but it will turn to a positive. How is that so inevitable? How can we turn it into a positive? What are the roadblocks to it necessarily becoming a positive? Because I can see two roads here. Actually, there's probably many roads, but I can see it becoming a lot worse.
Well, the optimism, apart from being the ethics of my own work, if you're going to be somebody that is paid for teaching and reading and writing, just give people some hope and don't get them depressed. Life is difficult enough. Get a life, as we say, and get a good life. Apart from that, I see it in essentially how fast and how how flexible our brains are. You see it in children. I don't know whether any of the people listening in have had the humiliating experience of playing any computer games with anybody the age of 4+. Mm. By the time you're trying to figure out what you should be doing, the kid has already done 26 games and is looking at you as some sort of fossil from the Jurassic Park area, shaking their head, saying, "What is wrong with you?" There's several good studies, one by Michel Serres, a philosopher that I really like, called Thumbelina, has been a bestseller back in Europe, where he says the brains of these children are being wired differently because they are exposed from a very early age to such fast interactive technologies. They swoosh everything. And of course, it has the disadvantage that when they touch something and does not react interactively, they throw it out and say, "Oh, that's just a piece of wood." So there is, again, the problem of adjusting them to the real world, where not everything is alive and intelligent and a smart device, but nonetheless, they are so much quicker. And I think this evolutionary capacity is what we need to put our trust on. We don't need to intervene through chips and implants. That's why I don't agree with the transhumanist. I think that this change will come necessarily, and it will have disadvantages. Our children don't learn to write cursively anymore. Everything is printed. If you look at the handwriting of our high school children, they all look slightly dyslexic. They don't write anymore. They are on a keyboard from the age of nothing. So there are adjustments. The education system has to take in these adjustments. But you can see also how quickly this evolutionary change will happen. And you also see it in people that are trained to think faster. Our jet pilot fighters, Formula One car driving, people that interact with the computing simulations at such speed that most of us will not be able to sustain. So I think it's an experimental phase, and I am a believer that evolution goes on. It's never accomplished. I think that the machines will help us grow better, but it has to be a conscious effort, a collective social effort. It will not happen by itself, but I think it can produce qualitatively positive results.
You've suggested that our experience of the world is always mediated. What do you mean by that?
Well, just look at us right now. You in Melbourne, me in Sydney, through several cabling and microphones. And when the listeners are coming in, they will be listening to us through any number of devices and probably sending the links left, right and center, or throw it out. I think there is no aspect of our social life today that does not involve some sort of technological mediation, some devices that connect us. In some ways, you can say it was always like that. Only when the connection was pen and paper or carrier pigeons, when it was material objects moving in the world that we could see and account for, we didn't understand how mediation played a role, how we were connected through objects. Now that the objects have become smart and interactive, all of a sudden they do take on a life of their own. I think thinking of them not as object, but as connectors, as vectors, as relational bridges to others, learning to embrace them as part of who we are. Again, the posthuman turn, it's not a bad thing to be otherwise human. I think there is a kind of a resistance to thinking the way we live, thinking adequately about the way we live. Somehow thinking always pushes us back to some a bit old-fashioned ideas. You know, I think, therefore I am. Actually, the machines do the thinking for us. Our economy is run by computational networks. Our defense system, our telecommunication, they're all run by computational networks that actually think faster than we do. They are not enemies. They are part of who we are. As a university person, I see so much of the critical intelligence of young researchers going into these technologies. They represent the brightest and the best of what we have. So why do we always think about them as them when they are really us?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because of course, humans are making these technologies. What I wonder about and whether some of the insecurity around human nature or humanity comes from is the fact that there is this digital divide. There are the people who make them who perhaps feel less insecure about that, and all of the people who will be displaced by them that you talk about. I mean, that is essentially bigger than a class divide, isn't there?
It is a very interesting point because, of course, the technologies are not only informational technologies. We have the other big branch, which is the biotechnologies, the genomics, which control our agriculture, our food production, our medicine, stem cell research, and all of that, which is really affecting our ability to produce and reproduce life. Since the Human Genome Program was fully decoded years back, our knowledge of our genetic system, our control over what used to be called the sources of life, is complete. Gene editing, which allows us to actually improve our genetic code in a program called Human Genome 3.0, that's absolutely part of our research and of what we do. The scale of the changes is extraordinary. And I think, again, as a woman of science, of research, I am so excited about all these changes. But then as a social scientist and a citizen, I also see the problems that this entails. If we are looking at job suppressions on this scale, if we're looking at the suffering of the planet in the Anthropocene with the climate change and the large amounts of plastic that are devastating the beautiful Australian coastline, if we're seeing at the price that this progress is the toll that it's taking, then we really need a transitional phase where we take the positive and the negative together without nostalgia, because this is not going to be stopped. This is the way we have, you know, invested for our future. But we need to assess the positive and the negative and make social plans that take care of the ones who run the risk of being left behind. There is a digital proletariat. Older people have difficulties accessing this technology. They are complex. They require good vision, nimble fingers, the ability to sit for hours. It's very, very selective. So we need to democratize the kind of technology, the access to technology, and have a social program, for instance, universal minimum wages, some sort of transition phase where the millions who lose their jobs will not fall into despair and marginalization. They will not get angry and become rabid xenophobe right-wing voters because they have been left behind. We will not have the anger of the dispossessed. It is, at the end of the day, a social-political issue of great importance. It requires a lot more of an open debate and an acknowledgement that there are positive and negatives, but what a fabulous moment to be alive in.
It is fabulous. It's great to hear your optimism, because I think we're at a particular moment in time where we are finally having a conversation we should have been having 15 years ago, 10 years ago, but we didn't, because we were overwhelmed by the pace, about what it means to be human and what it means to incorporate this level of technology and the trajectory it's on. But you also come from a feminist background. You were the founding professor of women's studies at Utrecht. Does that influence your views of what's happening now? I mean, does that make you consider can you
absolutely
go there?
But you know, as a young Melbournian, I went to study in France for my PhD, and I did work for many years for the ABC as a stringer for the women's program, for Julie Copeland notably, and you will find in the archives my interview with Simone de Beauvoir and things that I did for the gorgeous ABC.
Oh, stop it!
That I love so dearly. So it's a long love story and it's a long history. Yes. I do think that the feminist awareness plays a role insofar as, at least in European feminism, since the 18th century, women have been asking the question, am I human too? Mm. And we had to ask this question because we didn't have human rights. We were not considered citizens, not even after the French and American revolutions. Citizenship for women came really late. And we had to look at the suffragettes. We have to look at the 19th century and early 20th century for Europe. Europe a big battle. Things did not come easy. And so people that have not have human rights given to them, the others of the dominant subject, a subject that is necessarily historically male, white, heterosexual, urbanized, speaking a standard language, the others that are sexualized others, women, LGBT, queer, racialized others, natives, indigenous, non-Europeans, and the naturalized others, the animal, the planet, those non-human have the right to say, well, just a moment, how inclusive is your understanding of the human? The more you think about it also in the light of the technology, the more it is clear that the human is not a neutral term. It is actually a term that accesses rights of citizenship and rights of belonging. I mean, at the Sydney Biennale, Ai Weiwei has an exhibition about the refugees that is asking the question, are the refugees human? As if being human was some sort of privilege that some have and others have to fight for. And I think that that's a very, very kind of sobering thought. And again, I want to play it affirmatively. This is not about recrimination. It's about keeping the broader picture in mind. And again, saying that if we have the opportunity as a society, as a culture, in this moment between the fourth industrial revolution and the sixth extinction, to rethink what it means to be human, let's make it inclusive. Let's listen to the voices of those that historically have not been considered fully human, because they have a few lessons to teach us at this point, including endurance, resilience, generosity, forgiveness, and vision, and qualities which might, I point out, our culture at the moment is running very short of.
Look, it has been an absolute pleasure to be joined by you, Rosie. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Professor Rosie Braidotti has been my guest in the drawing room. Professor Braidotti is a philosopher and a distinguished university professor at Utrecht University.